Yes. So, members, this is a bill that we heard last week. It's Senator Sinjib's bill regarding energy. And I'll move that we get this bill. We reviewed it in the Tax Committee for the tax purposes, but it needs to get to energy so we can get it back to Senator Sinjib's committee to actually discuss the energy benefits. So I would move that Senate File 3397 is passed and referred to the Committee on Energy and Utilities, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. The bill is on its way to Senator Sinjib, the author. And then, members, we do have four bills today. And I do not see the... we're going to go ahead and start with Senate File 3588. That's my bill. And then when Senator Howe gets here, we will move to his bill. Senator Coleman, if you'd like to take the gavel. I have the wrong bill folder.
No, no, let's see. Okay.
Yes.
Moves Senate File 3588. Senator Nelson, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I move Senate File 3588. And members, I do, let's see. There's no author amendment, so we are ready to go. Senate File 3588 is a conformity piece that will help Minnesota conform to current federal law, specifically regarding qualified improvement property, or QIP. It is an improvement that's made by a taxpayer to an interior portion of a non-residential building if the improvement is placed in service after the building was first placed in service. Now, the CARES Act in March of 20 specified that QIP for property placed in services after a certain date may be appreciated over a 15-year period instead of the 39-year period generally applied to commercial property. And so this bill conforms to that treatment of qualified improvement property. Federal laws allow upfront depreciation, called bonus depreciation, and many states, including Minnesota, allow bonus depreciation to be taken as well, either by a deduction of a certain percent each year or recalculating the depreciation for each asset separately. And that's might sound a bit technical, but it's conforming to the 15-year depreciation rather than the 39. And I do have a testifier, Madam Chair, Mr. Todd Koch, who will speak a little bit about the impacts of this and why it's important. Mr. Koch.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Koch.
Thank you, Chair, Madam Chair. My name is Todd Koch, K-O-C-H. I'm a partner at John A. Knutson & Company, and I'm sorry I can't be there, but all our business tax returns are due today, so we want to make sure all those get handled timely. What this is about is really making so that it's not too difficult for people to handle a timing issue on Minnesota. Over time, we understand why, for budgetary reasons, the state of Minnesota cannot allow all assets to be deducted in 1 year. And that's a lot of what bonus depreciation does. What happened with that CARES Act amendment is it allowed qualified improvement property. Think of it as a tenant, you know, you got a tenant that moves into a building, you're making so that they can use the facility or restaurants and stuff like that as they change their insides. When that happens, for federal purposes, we're allowed to take it all at once, called bonus depreciation. What's happening is without this conforming is we have some assets that qualify for bonus for federal that can't because we didn't adopt that provision. Since it doesn't allow, it's not allowed for Minnesota purposes under the bonus definition, I have some assets I take as a percentage over a year, every year to conform with bonus, that's fine. But now I have to take this separate category of asset called qualified improvement property, remove it from bonus, and recalculate depreciation. Sounds like, well, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is I'm having to qualify for, follow this bonus depreciation rule, some assets some way, some assets another way. Minnesota, for over 20 years, has dealt with these timing issues for depreciation as a percentage over time. Now I'm having to do some assets as a percentage over time and some assets doing it over time. And by the way, for this asset, it's 39 years. And granted, we know the asset's not going to last that long, but then at some point, I'm going to have a large loss on disposal for Minnesota purposes. So it's just a timing issue. We want to help reduce the cost of compliance. We don't want to have to conform to this bonus difference in two different ways. Pick one, let us go forward with it. Don't make it more complex to comply with the law than really it needs to be or should be. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Koch. Members, any questions on Senate File 3588? Seeing none, Senator Nelson, any closing comments?
Yes, just briefly, again, this is, we'll retroactively adopt the amendment for qualifying improvement property as the federal government did as well. And this was scored as a technical amendment because the estimates had assumed that that 15-year property would be would qualify for the qualified improvement property. So with that, Madam Chair, I would renew my motion that Senate File 3588 pass.
Are we laying this over? Yeah. Okay.
And be laid over, Madam Chair.
All right. Senate File 3588 is laid over for possible inclusion. Next, we're up to Senator Howe. So. No.
Senator Howe, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Let's see. Senator Rust, would you like to move Senate File 3538?
My pleasure.
Thank you, Senator Rust moves. Senator Howe's bill, 3538, subtraction provision for certain public pension income. And Senator Howe, do you have an amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I have the A1 amendment, and I think Ms. Pollock has indicated that I need an oral amendment to the A1 amendment, and she could explain that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Pollock.
Yes, Madam Chair and members. Inadvertently, on the amendment, the change to the effective date in Section 2 was left off, and so to amend the A1 amendment, after 1.3, it would say on line 3.26, delete 2021 and insert 2022.
Senator Howe, we will pass that amendment. All those in favor signify.
To move it.
Oh,
move the amendment.
Senator Weber, could you please move the A1?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Weber. All those in favor of the author's amendment A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
The amendment is adopted. Senator Howe, two-year bill is amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, what this bill does is that if a member of the law enforcement, whether it be the state law enforcement community or the police and fire community, if they serve till their full retirement age of 55 and have a minimum of 20 years of service, this would exempt their pension from income tax. Now, as you know, that we're making a big push to make Social Security tax exempt. These individuals have no Social Security. They don't pay into Social Security, so they don't get a Social Security pension. Back a few years ago, we exempted military pensions. So this, to me, is right in line with all of that. And so the other thing I believe it does is it keeps it. Serves as a retention to keep people from possibly file for duty disability. It keeps them employed, and I think it's an excellent recruitment provision to keep people to serve till full retirement age and maintain them in our public safety departments. With that, Madam Chair, I'd like to go to testifiers.
Thank you, Senator Howe. Our first testifier is Mr. Mike Ledoux with the State Troopers. Mr. Ledoux. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Ledoux. I'm the president of the Troopers Association.
You may continue.
Madam Chair and committee members, as I said, my name is Mike Ledoux. I've had the honor and privilege of being a state trooper for 28 years. I am the president of the Minnesota State Patrol Troopers Association, and I testify today in that role. I am also the current chair of the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association, which represents all non-supervisory law enforcement officers employed by the state of Minnesota. I want to thank Senator Howe for authoring Senate File 3538, and I want to thank him for his advocacy for those that wear uniforms, whether it be for the community or the country. Unlike when I began my career, we have far more openings statewide than applicants to fill them. The State Patrol had funding for an academy of up to 75, but currently only has 12 cadets in our academy. This decline can partially be attributed to the demeaning, demoralizing, and dehumanizing of an entire profession. In Minnesota, law enforcement officers are retiring at unprecedented levels. If this trend continues, we will experience a public safety crisis not experienced in our lifetimes. I come from a proud law enforcement family which began their service in 1923 with my great-grandfather. I can assure you, after 99 years of service in the profession, this current crisis is unprecedented. Recent estimates indicate 25% of law enforcement agencies in the state have openings. It has also been estimated that the current openings fall between 1,200 and 1,500. To be successful, these agencies need the talent, tools, and training to prepare the next generation of officers. If passed, this bill would immediately help recruit and retain officers. This bill encourages officers to remain with their respective agencies until they reach full retirement age, allowing them to train the next generation of law enforcement officers. This bill encourages retirees to remain in the communities they have served and provides the obvious economic benefits of this residency. Members of the police and fire positions do not receive Social Security, and state law enforcement officers must mandatorily retire at the age of 60. 2021 was the deadliest year for law enforcement officers in history. Last year, 458 officers died in the line of duty, a 55% increase from the previous year. I am frequently thanked by citizens for my service, and it is normally followed by, I wouldn't or couldn't do your job. This bill provides recruitment incentives for individuals to enter these inherently dangerous occupations by providing a tax benefit in retirement. These problems with recruitment and retention will require a unified and coordinated effort. These public safety professionals put service before self each day for the security, benefit, and protection of the people, as described in the state constitution. Please recognize their service by supporting SF 3538. Madam Chair, I would be happy to answer any follow-up questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ledoux. We do know that our public safety has been under great stress. And how do you feel this would impact retention? That's something we're all interested in and concerned. Do you have a sense that this would impact either retention or recruitment?
I think, Madam Chair, committee members, I think it would do both. I think, as I pointed out, there's inherent risks associated with the occupations. Therefore, you have to provide some kind of reward, for lack of a better term, at the end of your career. Obviously, we have pensions, but more is needed because the numbers are staggering to anybody that's been paying attention. As far as retention, unfortunately, we've seen unprecedented levels of officers statewide that are reaching the age of 50 and opting to leave early, as opposed to staying to 55 for full retirement age. I think this bill would encourage those men and women to stay until full retirement age. And I'm sure if you asked any of the sheriffs, my colonel, or the police chiefs throughout the state, they would tell you these veteran experienced officers are invaluable, and we need them to train and prepare the next generation of law enforcement officers.
Thank you, Mr. Ledoux. That's what I was thinking about, was the, you know, skyrocketing resignations and losing all of that talent. So this would be a positive piece. Thank you. Senator Rest has a question. Senator Rest.
thank you, Madam Chair. These questions are either for Senator Howell or maybe Senate Counsel, because it's kind of background. How many other public employee groups don't receive Social Security regardless of when they retire? Do you know?
Ms. Pollack.
Or Senator Howell?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, I don't know that off the top of my head, but I can certainly get that information for the committee.
Senator Howell, I think that would be very interesting. As you can see from the revenue estimate, Madam Chair, Senator Howell, it could mean a lot to the recipients, but it doesn't cost the state a lot. And I think we could maybe look at that. And then, since the Social Security comes in now, you have to be, 66 and 1 month? Is that right?
Four
months? Okay.
This is my year.
You know, don't you? Is that what you're telling me? Thank you, Senator Weber. Other pensions of people that receive a pension and then also Social Security, they're coordinated. And there is a a total reduction in it. And what happens when somebody retires on this pension and at 60, and they've worked another job, and so they qualify for Social Security at 66 and 4 months. Until they qualify for Social Security at whatever level, this pension income would be exempt. But once they get to the Social Security income, if we don't repeal it completely, is the this pension income and Social Security coordinated?
Senator Howe, I saw you smiling.
Well, it's not quite the question I was prepared to ask, but I know that right now I receive a police fire pension, and I worked a second job my entire life. And what they do is they reduce my Social Security because I have an additional pension. So even though I earned the qualifying quarters and I've paid into it my entire life, I don't get the same amount of Social Security, nor is that Social Security currently tax exempt. So I'm not quite there to draw Social Security yet, but it's in my near horizon. So I can't. That's it. When you have a pension that didn't pay into it, we get a reduced Social Security off of that. So.
So Madam Chair, point I'm trying to get at is to make sure that when we exempt this pension income, that maybe it's in the revenue estimate that I haven't read, just looked at the numbers. Is that going to diminish their Social Security income to the point where exempting this allows them to receive the full Social Security because this is exempt income, will be exempting this income, or is it going to get coordinated and lose some of its value?
Senator Rest? I don't know that we have that question, the answer right at this table. We may have some more discussion. We could definitely find that is the interaction between exactly. Social Security and the pension is very important. And also, I'd like to know the interaction of those dollars that are put into the pensions and how they have been taxed or not taxed going in. But Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment that I think the Social Security benefits are, that's a federal issue. And we are not changing the exemption of pension income or Social Security income at the federal level. So what we do at the state level shouldn't really affect, in my opinion, what happens in their determination of those benefits. Because that will be considered exempt for federal I would guess they look at the exemption for federal purposes, et cetera, in determining that.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Weber.
Senator Rust.
So this pension income, to the extent that federal law applies to it, will remain taxable or non-taxable at the federal level. But, and it may, regardless of whether we tax it or not, the amount of Social Security that someone receives from these two sources, except under some particular circumstances where it's not, but for the most part, it's going to be coordinated and the Social Security income will be reduced. But whether you're saying, I think, whether we tax it or not at the Minnesota level is not going to be the determining factor of a reduced amount of Social Security at the federal level because it's coordinated. Is that?
That would be my opinion.
And that sounds like the opinion here, but we're going to get clarification to make sure. But that does sound like exactly what we would expect. But
okay. Maybe, Madam Chair, Mr.
Wilms
knows.
Madam Chair, Senator Rust, your earlier question about the groups of employment that have been excluded from Social Security benefits, according to a Congressional Research Service report, there's generally five major categories that are excluded. Those are civilian federal employees hired before January 1st, 1984, railroad workers who are covered under railroad retirement systems, and which is coordinated with Social Security, certain employees of state and local governments who are covered under their employer's retirement system, domestic workers and farm workers whose earnings do not meet certain minimum requirements, and then additionally, persons with very low net earnings from self-employment, generally under $400. Those are the five major categories that are excluded.
Thank you, Mr. Wilms. And Madam Chair, I think that's just kind of an interesting palette for us to keep in front of us.
Thank you, Senator Hill. Yes, and we'll get definitive answers on the interactions, of course. Our next testifier is Jeremiah Malquist, Central District President of the MPFF. Mr. Malquist, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jeremiah Malquist. I'm the MPFF Central District VP. Here representing the state of Minnesota professional firefighters. I've been honored and the privilege to work 22 years with the St. Paul Fire Department. I'm presently a deputy chief there and a chair officer with the Local 21. I'm here today to testify in support of Senator Howell's Senate File 3538 and thank him for authorizing it. A lot of the points I'm going to make will kind of back up what my friend from the State Patrol has already stated. Our members in the professional firefighters, when we retire, we do not receive Social Security benefits. Not only that, when we retire, our first 3 years, we're locked in at 0% COLA with our pension. After that, presently, it's a 1% a year COLA. It doesn't matter if the inflation rate is 6, 7, 8% like it presently is. We're locked in at 1% for the rest of our lives. Not only will this bill assist with recruitment, but more importantly, it will assist retention. In 1998, when I took the fire test and got on the job in 2000, there was over 3,000 applicants that showed up down at the Xcel Energy Center and packed the room. It was a diverse pool of candidates that we were able to hire for 5 years off that list. Our last list that we had an open test was less than 700 applicants. We presently have 470 members on St. Paul Fire. Of that, we're 47 short. We're trying to start an academy at the end of April, and we put job offers out and interviewed 100 people, and less than 40 have accepted. We have 50 people presently that are off long-term JD, which is putting pressure and stress on our members that are working. And this month alone, we have 10 people coming off early for job disability, whether it be injury, PTSD, no matter what it is, they're retiring early. Much like the police and state patrol, we are suffering on the streets with extra hours, extra run volume increases, and it's putting stress and pressure on all our members, and we've seen a spike in PTSD based on this. This bill would give us relief from the discrepancy of the 1% annual after the 3 years of 0%, plus it will help us with retention, with providing a goal for our members that do get to be 45, 50, get a little bit older in this work, instead of going off, they see if you work the full to 55 and put 20 years on, there's a reward at the end as opposed to going off on an injury. I thank you for your time, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, President Malquist. We know there's been enormous stress on all of our public safety during these last 2 years, and I think particularly of the our firemen, especially as there was such so many fires just right here around this metro area. And I've visited with some of them, and just the continual call after call after call after call. So we thank you and them for their work. And again, you feel this would help in really retaining and recruitment.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Well, the first year I was on the job in 2000, we responded 29,000 runs. This year we're on pace to respond over 60,000 runs with the same number of staff.
Oh, that's a staggering statistic. Staggering increase. Thank you for sharing that. Members, comments, questions? Senator Dietzig.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if you want me to ask the question now or wait. I think we have one other testifier.
Oh, yes. If it's not for President Malmquist, then just wait till later. Thank you, Mr. Malmquist. We do have one more testifier by Zoom, and that's Jim Mortensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for this opportunity to testify this morning on Senate File 3538. My name is Jim Mortensen, M-O-R-T-E-N-S-O-N, and I am the Executive Director of Law Enforcement Labor Services. I am also a 32-year police officer who retired at the rank of lieutenant in 2019 from the St. Cloud Police Department. Law Enforcement Labor Services is Minnesota's largest public safety labor union, and we represent over 6,700 members throughout the state of Minnesota who work in police, fire, dispatch, and the corrections profession. The public safety profession has been the football in a game of between politics and activists and the media for several years now. And we are here today to correct a problem that has now gotten out of control. The public safety nightmare that started in 2014 during the Ferguson, Missouri uprising and has continued into 2022 with other uprisings along the way, like what happened in the city of Minneapolis. Everything we do in society has a cause and effect. Over the past 8 years, the entire public safety profession in every state has been painted with the same demoralized brush because of the actions of only a few, which would be considered the cause. The effect is a dramatic downward spiral of anyone wanting to do these jobs anymore. And we are now in a time of crisis for recruitment and retention. We have a record number of unfilled positions in every job. And if there are not substantial corrective measures put in place, this problem is only going to get worse, not better. One may ask themselves, what will happen if we don't fill these vacant positions? Quite frankly, if these positions are not filled, low-level crimes, violent crimes, traffic fatalities will continue to happen. And the end result will be our citizens being victimized and dying. If you don't believe me, look back at the crime rates, homicide rates, and traffic fatality rates over the past couple of years. They are at record levels. Just like we need our military to protect our borders, we need our public safety professionals to protect us from each other. Without public safety, we would have anarchy and civil unrest, both of which were clearly present during the Minneapolis incident in 2020 until we called in enough reinforcements to stop it. Currently, there are 417 law enforcement agencies in the state of Minnesota. Of those 417, there are approximately 65 agencies attempting to hire police officers, and that does not account for all the sheriff's departments attempting to hire corrections officers and dispatchers. If you take just three of those 417 law enforcement agencies, being the Minnesota State Patrol, Minneapolis PD, and St. Paul PD, you need approximately 500 vacancies filled. In 2021, there were only 538 individuals who were issued a peace officer's license from the Post Board. So what about the needs of the other 414 law enforcement agencies out there? In 2021, I had our law clerk from my office conduct a study to see what is happening in our colleges that teach law enforcement and criminal justice. And it showed pre the Ferguson incident and post the Floyd incident that there has been an almost 27% reduction in our young adults graduating from these programs and wanting to go into these professions. We also have another unprecedented issue that has surfaced in all of this, which is having our current public safety professionals quitting their jobs in the middle of their career, or they are retiring early to get out of the job. In my 30 plus years of being a police officer, that was the anomaly, and now it is starting to become the norm. So how do we correct this? We need political leaders like yourselves to take the wheel of the ship and turn it around. These public safety professionals need your support in their time of need, just like you needed their support in your time of need. We need bold and innovative ideas like Senate File 3538 to be brought forward and to be put into law to recruit people into this profession and to retain people that are currently in the profession. On behalf of the 6,700 plus members of Law Enforcement Labor Services, I would ask for your support on Senate File 3538. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and I will be happy to answer any of your questions at this time.
I thank you, Mr. Mortensen. Any comments, members, or questions? Senator Dietzig.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Madam President. Thank you, Senator Howell, for bringing this bill. So I've had the bill in the past to look at either a subtraction or an equivalent subtraction for the other public pension plans that are not included in this. My understanding, and I don't know if they would be included in this right now because I don't know if most of them, the current teachers are part of this. I know there are current fire and police that are part of this and don't have Social Security, but there are retired teachers that also don't get, along with current retired law enforcement, that don't have that. One of the questions I have, but first I want to just, somebody, the way it was referred to, I'll say that I have family members that are firefighters, and my father was a police officer. So, but I would point out, instead of calling it, I would refer to the incident that happened in Minneapolis as the Chauvin incident. So I'll just make that comment. But my question is for either Jay or Nora. When I had those other bills, we had a big unknown because we didn't know how many people would be coming in from other states with a federal pension, and we also had to give that treatment. So what the other bills did was, again, make it equivalent to whatever we were doing with Social Security so that at least a portion of their pension was not taxed since they didn't get Social Security. Would, if somebody was a cop or firefighter in another jurisdiction, you know, and was 55 before this date, and they moved to Minnesota after they retired, would they qualify under this? And
Ms.
is that
Pollack?
Considered?
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzig, no, the bill does not apply to similar pension plans in other states. It does apply to similar pension plans at the pension plans at the federal level, but not from other states.
Okay, thank you.
Good question, Senator Dietzig. Any further comments? Senator Klein.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Howell, for the bill, and appreciate the creative solutions for retaining and recruiting law enforcement. It's an essential effort. I just had a question on 1.19, where you have the notwithstanding and sort of exempting this proposal from the tax expenditure review process that we passed last year, you know, which would sort of ask to have a statement of justification for any tax expenditure, which I think would be fairly straightforward in this case, and also have an expiration date for any tax expenditure. And was there a specific reason you wanted to exclude that from the tax expenditure review process and just for the committee to consider going forward?
Senator Howell.
Well, I think this is trying to continue to have those folks work through their, if possible, work through their disability to stay on full time, and that's the reason we kind of excluded that was trying to keep folks to stay till 55. That was the retention piece is the reason we excluded it.
Thank you, Senator Howe. Further comments? Senator Howe, any further comments, closing comments?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I think this is a step in the right direction to retain and recruit people into these professions that we're struggling with. And I know it's a cost, but I believe it's a cost worth enduring. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Howe, for bringing this bill. It will be laid over as amended. Thank you, Senator Howe. Next up, we have Senate File 3691.
All right, Senator Dietzig, would you move Senate File 3691 for Senator Nelson, please?
Well, I can move it.
Oh, you
can
move
my
it.
Own
okay.
file here. I'll move that file. Thank you.
All right, and Senator Nelson, I believe you have an oral amendment.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. There's a typo, actually. I know this does not happen very often, but we do have one here on line 1.13, and it's just a delete G-199 and insert G-99, and that is just referencing the PUC docket, the correct PUC docket. So I'd like to move that oral amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. I'm sorry to say she moves the oral amendment.
Yes, 1.13. If you look at line 1.13, you'll see a reference to the PUC docket. And it just has a typo. It is not G-199. It should be G-999. We just want to make sure we're referring you to the correct PUC docket.
Members, any other questions about the oral amendment? All right, Senator Nelson moves her oral amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Nelson, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 3691 provides tax relief to gas customers in Minnesota. You will recall the massive energy hikes that happened in mid-February. We had extreme and prolonged cold here in Minnesota, across the country, by the winter storm Uri, and it resulted in substantial increases in demand for natural gas. And then, of course, this was combined with the weather-related natural gas supply limitations, as you recall, in Texas. And so this was a large, short-term increase in natural gas prices. And I just want to emphasize those two words, large increase in a short term, because it's very significant. And in order to reduce the burden on customers, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission allowed the utilities to recover those costs over a period of up to 5 years. So I really had to think about that, to think that we had less than a week of those extremely high costs, and yet the PUC felt that it was important that consumers have 5 years to recover, to pay, like on the layaway plan, over those high costs. And while the natural gas purchased during the cold winter months is not subject to a sales tax, the Department of Revenue is requiring the utilities to collect sales taxes on all the recovery payments that are received during the months when natural gas is taxable. So it would be paying tax for recovery payments for during that winter time in February of 2021, when there should not have been tax. So we ought not be taxing something that was non-taxable when it was purchased. This bill would clarify that those recovery payments for gas used in February of 2021 are not subject to the sales tax, regardless of when the payments are made. There would be a credit for sales taxes already paid last year and a sales tax exemption for future payments. So that's the bill. Madam Chair, members, just a bit about that. I know we all remember that, that time of unbelievably high gas prices. And with that, Madam Chair, I have a testifier, and I'd like to have, if you could recognize Ms. Amber Lee, please.
Yes, Ms. Lee, please state your name for the record.
Good morning, committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 3691. I'm Amber Lee, a Director of Regulatory Affairs for CenterPoint Energy here in Minnesota. CenterPoint was one of four utilities who were impacted by the gas market spike that Chair Nelson referenced in her opening statements that occurred in February of 2021. During that event, gas utilities incurred extraordinary costs. In our case, we incurred about $400 million of gas costs over a five-day period. And because those costs are so significant, we needed to extend the recovery to limit the impact on customer bills. Under normal course, gas sales to residential customers would be tax exempt during the heating season from November to April. And under Senate File 3691, The costs for this period would be sales tax exempt for the entire recovery. In our case, that's 63 months. We estimate that this approach would save the average residential customer approximately $8, and CenterPoint supports this approach as a way to mitigate the customer impacts associated with this market event. We thank Chair Nelson for bringing this forward, and we're happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Members, any questions? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Nelson, I was wondering, have you thought about any language in the bill that would make such a change permanent? We seem to have to go back often to correct issues that arise within the department because they, in this case, are trying to collect tax on sales that didn't qualify for charging tax in the month of sale. There's a number of issues that we've had to go back and do this, and I was just wondering, have you explored any type of language for your bill that would make this change permanent so that the department knows that they cannot do those type of things for any type of collection in the future?
Senator Weber, that's a good question. I have not thought specifically about, this issue is so particular that I think your question is a broader question, though, which has to do with the Department of Revenue determining things that are taxable or not taxable, but usually taxable, that are newly taxable. In other words, it hasn't had any legislative authorization of the tax. It just is interpreting current events as being taxable, which I think does bear further scrutiny. And this bill is going to be laid over as amended, and if we can determine precise language that would prevent such a over-interpretation or a fluid interpretation, we can do so. But on the other hand, I want to be very clear in this language. I want to have the clarity at the same time that it's applying to these particular 5 days of extraordinarily high costs, not changing the law regarding taxation of utilities in those non-winter months. And so there's kind of that tension between being specific enough to meet the cause, meet the need, and yet being broad enough, as you note, is needed to make sure that we try and eliminate these type of things. Yeah. So I will take that suggestion under advisement, and we can certainly look if there is such language. It's kind of like the Goldilocks language, not too narrow and not too broad.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator Nelson, any closing comments?
No, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for the time. Thank you for bringing this need to us. We know Minnesota customers, utility consumers. I do want to add one thing, though, because this came to my mind as this bill was brought to me, and I want to make sure, I'm sure the members know this, but the public knows this as well. I wanted to know how the co-op utilities fared during this time. And the taxation during the winter months does not apply to those co-ops. So they were not affected by this overly broad DOR interpretation. So with that, I would renew my motion that Senate File 3691 is amended, be laid over.
All right, Senate File 3691 as amended will be laid over.
Thank you.
Yes. You have another bill, Senator Nelson, Senate File 3695.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move Senate File 3695, and I do have the A2 amendment.
All right, Senator Nelson moves Senate File 3695 to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the author's amendment, and it just inserts the amounts on line page 2, line 14.
What's the amendment number?
Pardon me?
A2.
Okay. The A2.
All right, Senator Nelson moves the A2 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Nelson, to your bill.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair. Well, this is not a new bill to this committee. Those of you who have been on the Tax Committee for a while, probably as long as I've been here, we have been working on this issue regarding charitable gaming and the fact that they are taxed at such a high rate that they don't have money in many cases to continue their mission. So I'm going to give you just a little bit, and this a bill would address that. And I'll give you just a little bit of background just to kind of refresh your memory. In 2014, charities paid about 22% of their net receipts. Of course, that would be sales minus prizes to the state for taxes and fees. And now by 2020, that percent had grown to 27% paid for state taxes and fees. And then in 2017, this was really a staggering moment. Charities reached the point where they paid more in taxes and fees than they had available for donations to their communities. That's their mission. That's why they exist. And I heard from many of the charitable gaming institutions in my town that were so concerned about that, wondering if they were even going to continue to pay taxes for the sole purpose of paying taxes, not their mission, whether it be to support the Boy Scouts or Rochester Youth Baseball or the veterans organizations. Suddenly they were tax collectors more than mission preservers. So now currently, after paying taxes of a 27% and expenses of about 53%, the average charity has only 20% left to contribute to mission and community. And that equates to only 3 cents per dollar wagered available for charitable contributions. So without much needed tax relief, the charitable organizations will continue to see state taxes consume more and more of the charitable gaming dollars and thereby limiting their ability to contribute to their missions and community. Taxes and fees impact both the large multiple site charities and the single site charities. Many are paying more in taxes and fees than they do for mission and community. This file, Senate File 3695, modifies the rate and the tax brackets on which the combined net receipts tax is imposed. The bill also strikes obsolete language and adds updated language pertaining to the calculation of the revenue increase from the combined net receipts tax. That's a brief snapshot of the bill, Madam Chair. I do have four testifiers.
All right. It looks like your first testifier is Ms. Rachel Jenner. Ms. Jenner, please identify yourself for the record and then continue with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Jenner, and I am the Executive Director of Allied Charities of Minnesota. We are here today in support of Senate File 3695 to reduce taxes on charitable gambling. I'd like to say thank you to Senator Nelson for authoring this bill for us. In fiscal year 2021, our organizations, of which there are just over 1,100, donated over $80 million in their communities. And these donations are vital to supporting local communities by providing funding for youth programs, food shelves, fire departments, and various county programs that have no other funding. And we are very proud of the work we do locally and our ability to serve in so many ways, but many organizations are struggling to fund their programs and the charitable requests that they are receiving due to the heavy tax burden. In the same year that we donated over $80 million, our state tax bill was $120 million. That's $35 million more paid in taxes last year than available for donations. So we are asking today that we correct this. Our expenses are actually the lowest that they've been in years, which is a testament to how these organizations are working to keep their expenses low and maximize their donations. E-gaming is a growing segment of our industry. It's now 46% of our industry's revenue, but these games are expensive. The cost of an e-game is 31% of its revenue. So if an organization is at the max tax rate of 36% and then paying 31% for the cost of the game, we then pay 15% in rent, and that leaves us only 18% to pay our overhead costs and find money to donate. So these margins with rising costs, rising inflation, are just getting slimmer and slimmer. I spoke with one organization who is struggling to raise $200,000 to put a new ice rink in their community. Their monthly tax bill is over $100,000. So they're contributing $1.2 million in state taxes and struggling after they have their program expenses and they pay their ICE bills to save $200,000. So for 5 years, as Senator Nelson stated, we've now paid more in taxes than we have available for donations as an industry. And I know that one concern in the past has been that lowering taxes would somehow increase expenses. But we operate under a lawful purpose rating that's overseen by the Gambling Control Board that requires us to donate or to spend 30% or more of our revenue on donations and taxes. So if our taxes go down, our donations need to go up to fill that gap, or our lawful purpose rating would fall. And if your lawful purpose rating falls below 30%, your gambling license will be revoked. So there are safeguards in place that will help us, you know, to backfill any tax relief with donation dollars. And that's really why all these organizations are in business, is to serve their mission and provide maximum donations in their community. You know, we've continued to see revenue growth year over year, and with progressive tax rates, that just means that our average taxes increase year over year. The stadium fund is currently overfunded, and annually we're now sending nearly four times what's needed to pay those stadium bonds. So if ever there has been a time to reduce our taxes, we feel like the time is now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jenner. Moving on to Mr. Robert Lee Hart. Welcome, Mr. Hart. If you could please state your name and who you're with for the record, and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Robert Hart, and I'm the legislative chairman for the American Legion Department of Minnesota. I am authorized to speak on issues about charitable gambling on behalf of the approximately 550 posts in the state, but most specifically on behalf of the 200 posts that are engaged in this fundraising effort. I'm also a long-serving gambling manager for my post 48 in Stillwater, so I'm quite familiar with the day-to-day operations and reporting requirements. The American Legion has two gambling seminars each year for gambling managers, which is conducted by the Minnesota Gambling Control Board. At least one training course is required by the board to maintain certification as a gambling manager. The most common complaint is the confiscatory taxes paid to the state on charitable gambling proceeds. The first complaint is that these taxes are paid on net proceeds and not net profit. I know of no other business or charity that is taxed on this basis. The other and more pressing issue, the rates charged for gambling in general. Here again, no other endeavor is taxed at rates of 9, 18, 27, and 36% of net proceeds. The result of this, in the fiscal year 2021, the state took 60% and the charities were left with 40%. The question that strains the conscience is, how is that morally acceptable? It is our opinion that the state should take no more than is needed to provide proper oversight over the program and ensure efficacy. I am here today to advocate for reduction in these horrific rates. The rates in this bill is a start, but the charities have many needs to address in their communities that would never get the attention of the state legislature. There are 300,000 veterans in the state of Minnesota, 550 posts in communities all over the state. In many cases, the programs of the American Legion are funded by the 200 posts that have gambling licenses. The charitable gambling funds earned by these posts should be used in those communities and not dumped into the general fund for pork barrel spending. I suspect that all other charitable organizations would agree. The tax system in use today has been in place for years, and I hold no one here accountable for that. I would only ask that this be remedied. I thank you for your time, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hart.
Thank you.
Next up is Ms. Nancy Hubger, Metro Baseball League. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Nancy Huber. I'm the gambling manager for Metro Baseball League. We're out of Burnsville. I've been a gambling manager for 14 years now, and when I began doing charitable gambling for Metro Baseball League, we were doing approximately $40,000 to $50,000 a month. And now we're in the range of, you know, doing about $300,000 a month, which means our tax bill is just outrageous. In the month of February, on an average, I pay about $107,000 a month in taxes to the state. And it's about 51.69% after with the net revenue, it goes into taxes. So there's not a lot left after we get done paying the employees, paying for all the games and everything else that we have to pay for, the overhead. It leaves little to be donated. And our goal is to make sure that, you know, all the kids for youth baseball has an opportunity to play, whether they can afford it or not. We offer scholarships. So as many scholarships as we can offer for make sure that kids can stay in the sports, sports is our goal. So if you could please look at this again, we've been asking for 4 or 5 years now to please get this reduced. I'm way over 36% every month. And for me to spend $107,000 to $108,000 a month on taxes, it's ridiculous. You know what? And like he was saying with the American Legion, it goes into the general fund. It'd be one thing if the taxes were being used for homeless people, for veterans, something that was, you know, if we have to pay that big taxes, then why doesn't some other charitable organization be able to use that money versus the general fund? And that's all I have to say. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Senator Nelson, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not.
Thank you.
Oh, one more. Mr. Jenkins.
Welcome.
Glad you're here.
Good morning.
Please state your name and who you're with and begin your testimony.
All right. My name is Glenn Jenkins. I'm the gambling manager for St. Paul Firefighters. I'm a 21-year district chief with the city of St. Paul and a third-generation firefighter. Growing up, one of the big things that was beat into my head by my parents, my grandparents, and my family was service to community. And when I saw the opportunity to become the gambling manager for the St. Paul Firefighters, I thought, what a great opportunity to be able to give money back to the people in the community that we serve. St. Paul Firefighters has two missions, youth athletics and helping people with debilitating injuries. Most of the firefighters that are within St. Paul played sports in high school, college, and beyond, some of them. And what a great way to teach discipline, hard work, and most of us grew up in a time when sports was just something that you did. This last year, I had two instances where we had the Johnson High School football team approach me for money, Coach Moberg, and asked us for a donation for his kids. And I thought, you know, how ridiculous. My high school provided me with the equipment, jerseys, everything else. And what he was asking for the money for was for lunches to feed the kids so that they would come in and work out, because often the only good meal that they would get is at lunch when they got their workout in during the summer. I'm sorry, Johnson High School is on the east side of St. Paul. If people aren't familiar, it's 5 miles from here. And these kids, they came in, and how many kids that made a difference to where they had the opportunity to work out and get a good meal that day or get a ride from Coach Moberg to practice because parents couldn't get them there. Sometimes there's not parents there to get them there. We were also approached by the East Side Athletic Association. It's an association that's using basketball to get kids off the streets and on the basketball court. They're also on the east side of St. Paul, not more than 5 miles from here. At the beginning of the year, these kids had no uniforms. They were showing up to tournaments in t-shirts that they drew their numbers on with magic markers. And they were going out and winning routinely, embarrassing kids from bigger communities that had much better equipment. St. Paul Firefighters Local 21 was able to buy them uniforms. And the pride that you saw in these children's faces once they got their own uniform with a number that wasn't a magic marker so that they looked like everybody else. The pride that they had, the difference that that money made to them, we'll never know. I've been the gambling manager for St. Paul Firefighters for 13 years, or 14 years, I don't really remember right now. I've been coming in here a lot longer than 4 or 5 years asking for tax relief. I believe we've been coming in here almost a decade, but my memory might not be serving me correctly. If you look at, I don't know how many people are familiar, but if you go in and you buy a dollar pull tab, I can't be like the gas company and charge you $3 a gallon. I can only charge you a dollar for a dollar pull tab. I can't raise my prices. I mean, how many of you would spend I think it's up to $2.30 now is what we should be charging for a dollar pull tab if we went along with inflation. How many of you would spend $2.30 on something that costs a dollar? Nobody. It doesn't make sense. The amount of taxes, the tax relief we're asking for isn't going into my pockets. It isn't going into my union. It isn't going into anything other back into the community. It's money that would go straight back into the community. I believe, I may be wrong, the agreement we made was $60 million of tax revenue to the state. 30 for the stadium, 30 for the general fund. I believe last year we paid almost $100 million. So that extra $40 million goes back into the communities, unimpeded by the political process, back to where it needs to be, to your constituents, where the money makes the most difference, to little kids, to sick people. In my time doing this, I've talked to a lot of representatives, and one of the common things I get is they don't want to support this because it's gambling, it's a sin tax, it'll look bad if I support something that's gaming. Well, people often don't see that the good that this money does. And in this case, the ends does justify the means. Thank you. I'll answer any questions too if anybody has them.
Thank you very much. Members, do we have any questions? Senator Bach?
Well, I'm not sure it's as much a question as, you know, when we start talking about gambling taxes and the combined receipts tax, just a little reminder for the committee, for those of you that are new, the combined receipts tax was put in place for one reason. It was to raise money for the general fund. And my predecessor, Doug Johnson, was the chair of the tax committee at the time. That the big joke is the whole idea was hatched on a napkin down at the Kelly Inn one evening. But it was in, I believe it was in 1981, and the state had an incredible deficit. And we had had 6 special sessions. Members, if you can believe this, they had had the legislature would come in, balance the budget. A month later, there'd be another, they were doing forecasts every month the recession was so deep. The next month, they'd come in and have to find more revenue or make more cuts. 6 special sessions in 1 year just to figure out how to keep the state budget in balance. The finance commissioner resigned. The state was in chaos. This was one of the pieces that was enacted in 1981. I think the history is all important. It was done for one reason, to raise money for the general fund. And then let me move on to the where I get a little concerned about the combined receipts tax is the electronic pull tab issue. I was part of that whole conversation in the governor's reception room when the legislature authorized electronic pull tabs. And they did it for one reason. We did not do it. Nobody thought we were doing it to help the charities or to help charitable contributions. And I'll acknowledge they do a lot of good work all over in our communities. But electronic pull tabs were authorized for one reason. It was to pay for the debt service on the U.S. Bank Stadium. That's what it was for. That's why the money off them goes to pay for the debt service and the bonds, and the balance goes to the stadium reserve fund. And as long as we don't jeopardize that fund right now and the revenue stream that comes into it, in 2023, the state's going to be able to call the bonds and refinance them. We are probably going to cut 10 years or more off of the debt service on the stadium. And there will be a lot of money for the charities because the money will still keep coming in. and the debt service will be significantly reduced. So, Chair Nelson, I just would say it's probably a good bill. It's probably about 2 years too early. I'm going to ask the question. I don't know if maybe Senator Nelson, maybe it's Revenue has to answer where the appropriations got put in to try and hold the Stadium Reserve Fund, how that was calculated, try and hold that harmless. But and the other thing, Senator Nelson, I think to think about if you're thinking about putting this in the bill, when we did the electronic poll tabs to fund the stadium, we didn't know if it was going to raise enough money. So we put a couple blink-on taxes in law that potentially could blink on if the electronic poll tabs did not raise enough money. And one of them was a 10% tax on luxury suites at the stadium. And then there were additional opportunity for sports-themed lottery games to help bring in some money if the charitable or if the electronic poll tabs weren't producing the revenue that we needed. So, Senator Nelson, I would just suggest as we move forward, if there's enough money to cut taxes on the electronic poll tabs, that's an admission that we don't need the blink-on taxes any longer in law. And I know that the team would like to get rid of those. It's hanging over on their balance sheet. I don't think we're ever going to enact them unless we end up cutting taxes so far that we jeopardize the revenue stream for the stadium. But just a little history and some thoughts. You know, we tax cigarettes at one of the highest rates in the country because it's a sin tax. We tax alcohol at 3% more, I think 3% more than we tax anything else on a sales tax because it's a sin tax. And we tax gambling higher too because it's discretionary spending. And things that are discretionary spending, whether it's cigarettes or alcohol or gambling, I think traditionally has been treated different in the eyes of the legislature when it comes to taxation. So just want to remind everybody of the commitment we have to the stadium. There'll be a lot of money for the charities going forward once we get that stadium paid off. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Barr.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Senator Bach, for reminding us of what the purpose of the It's that F1 key that I keep messing with. Part of these taxes go to problem gambling programs. And it looks like coming up, maybe this year or next year, whenever, we are hell-bent on introducing sports betting. And no doubt there will be even more need for funding programs that deal with people who are addicted to gambling. And there, and that's true with the taxes on lawful gambling here, too. And it's my understanding that if we reduce these taxes to the extent that's in this bill, that we would be losing $900,000 to programs for problem gambling. And we can check on that number, but it's a very big number. And I just think when we take everything into account, we, number one, as Senator Bach pointed out, go back to what the original purpose of taxing lawful gambling, charitable gambling was. And it was indeed to raise money for the general fund. And we also included in that the acknowledgement that there are many problem gamblers in Minnesota. Minnesota is one of the highest gambling states in the country. We spend billions of dollars on on gambling. And I think we just need a whole picture when we move forward with a bill like this. And I think we're going to see many more families ruined by problem gambling going forward. And I just think we just need a broad picture of it. And appreciate your comments, Senator Bob. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Members, any other questions? Seeing none, Senator Nelson, to your bill.
Yes, just a few final comments. I really thank the committee for the good thought, the questions. I thank the testifiers for sharing exactly how this bill would allow them to continue on with their missions. I would just note a couple things. And I do appreciate the history on when this charitable gaming tax began. And note, and I wasn't here at that time, Senator Bach, and I'm very glad you brought that history forward. Massive, massive state budget shortfall, deficit. I wasn't there for that one, but I've been around for a couple others. And I know that a lot of times things get enacted for those emergency situations to balance the state budget. And I think what we see is those emergency measures stay in place. And they stay in place, and they stay in place, and they stay in place until they're removed by law. And what I would note is that we don't have a budget deficit now. Obviously, you all are well aware at this table, we have over a $9 billion projected surplus. And our reserve coffers are full as well at over $2.5 billion. So we're not in that deficit mode. And I also wanted to note the stadium reserve is critically important, and that will be maintained. And of course, because the stadium reserve has grown significantly, we do look forward to paying off those bonds early. So I think, again, that is a good piece. And to the problem gambling. Senator Rest, I'm glad you brought that up. I am also concerned about problem gambling. And I think I will entertain a way as this bill to address that as we move forward with this bill. But I would note, and I'm sure you know, members, you are seeing charitable gaming in your local communities, supported by your constituents, and supporting local missions. You're seeing them close up because they don't want to be tax collectors. And that's what they're being turned into. And I would hate to lose that local impact of citizens volunteering and to come and do charitable gaming to support the missions that are so important to them. And I would just say that, you know, as those margins get slimmer and slimmer and the taxes are more and more, there is less money for mission. And I know you've heard this before. No margin, no mission. And we don't want to lose the good mission that our charitable gaming has done. And we have lost too many already. I can name them in my district, and I bet you can too. So I appreciate the good comments today, the history as well. Oh, one other thing I'll just note, I was in this room when we passed the Viking Stadium bill. I was on local gov at that time. And also just to note the accuracy of those electronic poll tabs. We didn't think there was going to be enough money to pay the stadium reserves. And so they have taken off, and we are glad about that. Thank you for your time today, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. And Senate File 3695, your intent is to lay it over, correct? Senator Bach.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, Senator Nelson. And I wouldn't expect you might know this, but maybe revenue could tell us the appropriations to hold the stadium reserve fund harmless. How were those calculated? The revenue is growing significantly on gambling taxes. Matter of fact, I think the money available last year, I think if I remember the sheet, the money available last year for the organizations to donate to their charitable purposes was double what it was prior to the passage of the electronic poll tab. So the revenue available to spend on charitable purposes is growing significantly. I'm just wondering, Senator Nelson, how revenue calculated the appropriations that are in the bill on the stadium reserve fund. And if you know,
well, I know who knows, which I think is Mr. Mr. Wells.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Bach. So when the stadium reserve was authorized and the taxes were authorized in 2012, they established a lawful gambling base at $36.9 million. So revenue above that base level, which is what revenue collections were at that time for this tax, was then set aside for the calculation of the stadium reserve amount. So what the amendment today did resets the base lower, basically to say that the increment that's cut in taxes doesn't affect the money that's available for the stadium reserve calculation. So it lowers that charitable gambling base level to basically hold the whole stadium reserve calculation and the money that goes into it harmless. It results in, a little bit extra for the stadium reserve, approximately $200,000 as identified in the revenue estimate.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Senator Nelson. Senate File 3695, as amended, will be laid over. And that's it today, I believe. Our next meeting, yes?
Senator Nelson?
Yes.
I recognize tax committees don't operate with the same deadlines that everyone else does. However, there are some bills that I would appreciate if you could release to the property tax subcommittee, because they are somewhat, a couple of them are very complicated, and we need to make sure we have everything arranged, and there's only a few meetings left before we can have that done. I was wondering if you could consider that today.
Yeah, why don't you, do you want to email those numbers to me? I don't know which bill numbers those are, but we can, today's Tuesday. We could look at those on Thursday, or you and I can look at those bills right now. I don't have those bill numbers nor what they are, but I'll be glad to talk with you about that and look at that on Thursday.
Very good. Thanks.
Thank you.
Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Weber, thank you, because I think I have three bills in the committee that I think probably should be heard by the division. So if someone's looking to put a list together about what needs to be sent to the division, I personally have three. But I think we would hear there rather than in the full committee.
Madam Chair, yes. Thank you. I think those are good points. We are going through our list of all the bills that have been referred to the tax committee and trying to decide which ones are going to get hearings. We never have quite enough time. Want to make sure we get those property tax ones to the subcommittee, Senator Weber's subcommittee on property taxes. So we will look at those on Thursday. And Senator Bach, I'm aware of your three.
Senator Rest.
I would also point out that yesterday on a bill was misdirected to education. It's a tax increment financing bill. It is Senator Ports, and Ms. Havisto was going to contact you and the Ed Finance Chair to make sure that the proper referral is made. It'll have to be an author's motion on the floor, but that one, in terms of looking at TIF, would need to come to taxes and then be considered by the property tax
thank you.
Committee.
Yeah. Thank you.
So it's coming.
We'll look for that as well.
Thank you.
Everyone set? All right. Thank you all very much. The next hearing will be Thursday, March 17th, 2022. We are adjourned.
Thank you.